Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on Personal Finance with Nick Abrams. He's a certified financial planner. And Leah Abrams, she's a certified public accountant. So taxes are due next Monday. What do we need to know about taxes and investing to position ourselves for the short term and the long term? So Nick and Leah Abrams will join me tomorrow to answer your questions and mine about personal finance. I hope you can join us then. Now we're going to turn to Ethan McLeod and Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal for a check-in about what's happening on the development front in Baltimore. Melody and Ethan join us on Zoom. Hey, guys, good to talk to you.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Doing fine. Hanging in there. Running scared, but straight ahead.
Yeah. Good to be here, Tom. Thank you.
So, Ethan, let me start with you. You wrote a piece about an organization called Black Women Build. Mac McComas and I were just talking about racial wealth disparities here in Baltimore and several other post-industrial cities. These are developers who are looking to, you know, overcome blight, et cetera. Talk about what they're doing and how successful they've been.
Sure thing. So this was a really interesting story. It was actually sort of a dual story. The first part was about Black Women Build. It's a nonprofit. It is founded by Shelley Halstead. She's a very skilled, trained carpenter and home renovator who can honestly do a lot of these home renovations on her own. But she has been working in Central West Baltimore areas like Drude Heights near Upton. She's been buying up vacant blighted properties from the city for a few years for a few thousand dollars at a time usually. She's often targeting ones that are right next door to each other because if you're trying to turn around a block, you want to make a more concentrated dent. So unlike a typical developer who might go for one scattered house, she's using this nonprofit to also just boost homeownership for other Black women. So she'll recruit a Black woman interested in becoming a homeowner. She'll work alongside them to renovate the house. It's such cool work. And they follow historic preservation guidelines, building it to suit the owner's needs. And at the end, you have somebody living in a house. You have hopefully a couple of these done at a time. So you, again, make more of a dent in the block. And you have tax revenue coming into the city. So that was one part of it. A lot of that work is grant and donation funded. And Black Women Build is up to, I think, at least a dozen houses at this point.
And you mentioned that it's, you know, a grant and donation funded because for a long time, the problem with renovating some of the houses in some of the blighted neighborhoods has been that the cost of renovating it is considerably more than the market value of the house. So it's tough to convince banks to lend money to homeowners in those instances because it just doesn't seem like a very good investment bet on their hat, on their part. So have they overcome that barrier by doing it as a nonprofit and doing it, you know, with donated and grant funds?
So that's something the other focus of this story, which was Bree Jones of Parity Homes. She and Shelley both really talked about this. Having to rely on the funding stream is just not ideal. You've got such high competition for some of these subsidies that are made available that it can become a very charged race to see who can land those funds. But they are succeeding. Bree is working in Harlem Park, looking to do things at sort of a bigger scale. She's looking at turning around 10 continuous blocks, recruiting pipelines, quote unquote, of home buyers. And but to do this work at scale, I mean, you're depending on a constant stream of subsidy. What you referenced, it's known to many as the appraisal gap. So there it hasn't been addressed. There has been legislation sponsored by Delegate Brooke Learman and Senator Antonio Hayes that actually passed through the General Assembly this past session. And it would create a new state funding mechanism to help developers cover that appraisal gap. So this is sort of a first of its kind thing in Maryland to help prop up developers and cover that gap. And it's seen as a vital tool and something that people are pretty eager toward getting, depending on federal funding coming in for it.
Ethan McLeod's an associate editor at the Baltimore Business Journal. Melody Simmons is here as well. She's a reporter who covers real estate and economic development for the BBJ. To join our conversation here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR. So, Melody, there is some reason for hope and optimism when it comes to development, really in many areas of the city, some of which have for a long time, you know, been underserved. You wrote a big piece about a huge residential development project that's going on in Park Heights. Tell us about that one.
Well, that's pretty exciting, Tom. We saw some of the plans last week when they came into City Hall, and this is 17 acres, and it's a $100 million investment in Park Heights. And if you know the community and some of the community advocates out there, they've been really waiting for this for many, many years. It's still about 2 years off for breaking ground because, as Ethan was talking about, the financing still has to be staffed and put together. And that is often a tedious task in some of these communities that have suffered from decay. But this project is a game changer. It actually has Baltimore City's first cluster of single family homes that are going to be detached homes that are going to be built in Baltimore in many decades. So that's very exciting. And it's also exciting to have the affordable housing and some of the market rate housing in the apartments that are going to be coming up online.
And Ethan mentioned Uplands. That's one of those projects that, you know, you drive by there over on the west side and on Route 40, and you see all sorts of activity for a little while, and then all of a sudden you see nothing. I mean, it just seemed to grind to a complete halt. What's the status of that big Uplands project over on the west side?
Well, Uplands is also on the upswing. So, and that, you're right, that part of the Uplands, it's been divided into two parcels over there. One has been barren for years. The other was developed. And then the development on the second part just stopped. So we're hearing now that Penrose is coming up and they're putting in infrastructure. They've gotten a grant from HUD. So it's going to be a whole new ball game out there when they put up all affordable housing rental units on that site. And they actually had to restructure their financing to include some retail. I hear a very large coffee chain has signed a lease or is very close to signing a lease. I don't want to mention which one, but I think they're based in Seattle. And so this is exciting for that part of town because it adds a shot in the arm economically, but also the housing opportunities for the residents is really exciting. And it shows that these communities that are not really located in some of the more affluent parts of the city are finally getting a spotlight and finally getting some development.
Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal. Ethan McLeod is here as well. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And Ethan, you wrote about a new loan pool that is going to be made available, I guess, by the city for smaller developers. I mean, Melanie talked about the $100 million project out in Park Heights, but there's a $3 million pool now for people who are home ownership focused. What does that mean? What kind of person is going to qualify for this kind of support? What's the timeline on that program getting underway?
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, to be clear, and as you sort of just referenced, not every neighborhood's going to get $100 million redevelopment. And maybe that's years down the line for certain areas. Maybe they're not fit for it. But where it can start, some of this economic turnaround is with these blocks, with these stretches of vacance that you might see. So, again, back to our original, what we originally touched upon, what incentivizes somebody to go into a vacant house and make it livable and try to sell it. Well, you need, you, in addition to wanting to help a neighborhood, you want to be able to turn a profit. Smaller developers often struggle to access the traditional financing going through banks. This fund, it's called the Dash Fund. It is financed in large part by a Pew era entity called the Neighborhood Impact Investment Fund. It's been running for a few years in the city, and it targets areas, low-income areas with redevelopment potential. So this is a $3 million pool. It's geared toward emerging developers. I haven't seen the application, but they have to, you know, qualify, surpass certain benchmarks to qualify for one of these loans. They're smaller loans. They range from, according to spending board minutes that I had read, it's ranging from $85,000 to a little under $163,000. So you're talking about, you know, enough to help finance, say, one or two home renovations at a time. This is what many see as making a difference on a neighborhood level, not waiting on a major project to come in, but to start with a block-led revitalization and to touch on some of what Mac referenced, it being Black-led. So Black developers, like many other Black-owned businesses, often struggle to access traditional financing pools.
Yeah, and Melody, you also written about a kind of grim anniversary that's coming up in just a week or two, and that is the second year that Harbor Place has been in receivership. Has anything happened in that regard? I mean, Harbor East seems to have taken all of the luster, all the attention, all of the fancy schmancy glossy companies and stores and offices. The downtown business district is really a very different kind of place and a different vibe than it was just a few years ago. What are you hearing from people in that central business district, and what's your understanding of where things stand with Harbor Place?
My understanding today, Tom, is that it is stuck in limbo, the limbo of receivership, which has been described as like the death of 1,000 paper cuts. And so what we're seeing in our city right now with the Central Business District and also with this beautiful landmark at the Inner Harbor is kind of like a Shakespearean drama. We don't know which way it's going to go. But everybody is kind of watching it. Everybody is rooting for it to, you know, pick itself up and move forward. The latest I heard was that the receiver himself is suing the remaining tenants for back rent that basically they were not able to pay because they were forced to shut down during the pandemic. So timing wise, everything, you know, hit really badly. It went into receivership, then the pandemic hit. We've had more vacancies. And so Harbor Place, which celebrated 40 years last July, is still very much in limbo.
And, you know, this really, you and I have talked about this before. This is a huge opportunity for the Scott administration, isn't it? I mean, just as William Donald Schaefer back in the 80s transformed that area and created Harbor Place, to think about it anew and to revise it and to revitalize it is really an opportunity for Brandon Scott to leave his mark on the city, isn't it?
That's right. And I think the mayor, Mayor Scott, realizes this. I think that he is really committed to trying to turn it around and really revert it back to a local, very locally based business. Creativity. You have all kinds of wonderful small businesses, many of them Black-owned and Black-led in our city, that would just be so honored to have a spot at such a high-profile location. So I think this is some of the new energy that we're hearing as far as planning goes. Even though there's no movement on the legal level, there is a lot of talk and there's a lot of wish list going on now about what could happen at that spot. Retail-wise, I think Mayor Scott realizes that he basically has an opportunity to set a legacy for himself.
And Ethan, the pandemic and the impact of the pandemic, the effect of COVID-19, you wrote a piece about a person starting a new business at the Rotunda over in Hamden that was sort of animated by her circumstances having to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. Overall, how do you think that's affecting people's will, people's optimism, people's interest in investing in areas around the city?
Yeah, you know, it's a really, it's a highly polar issue, right? Did the pandemic ruin your life or did it spur you to sort of reimagine? Sometimes it's both. So that was the case with Melanated, that it's a beauty store opening at the Rotunda. And I've heard many stories like this, and I'm sure Melody has too, over the last year and a couple months, just people being pushed sort of off a cliff by the economic circumstances of getting laid off. And maybe they found financing elsewhere. Maybe they went into their retirement funds. But people are, there is a certain willingness to take risks and to start a new business venture like that. And you're seeing it in neighborhoods all over. It's not just concentrated in the, I mean, Hamden's an area with a thriving business scene, but you're seeing it in Southwest. You're seeing it up in Northeast off Bel Air Road. So yeah, there's lots of sort of inspiring stories like that happening.
Yeah, and Mel, in our last minute or so, Under Armour, it seems that they have revised their plans fairly considerably about what they want to do on their office campus in Port Covington. What's the latest on that?
Well, they gathered us about a month ago and unveiled some very preliminary designs for the new corporate campus, which will be located on that 50 acres, kind of the whole of the donut at Port Covington. They have no timeline. They have no cost estimates, but basically they have revised their campus to reflect post-pandemic world. And that means that a lot of the Under Armour, what they call teammates, which is their employees, will still be working some from home, some in the office. And they have different levels and layers of that workforce. And they explained to us that they need less space. And so they have very early designs for a corporate campus. Of course, it includes a humongous store with Under Armour products for sale in there as well. So we're just starting to, you know, understand what they're saying about how that might, unveil as the future year or so rolls out.
Sure. And of course, it looks like, you know, they've abandoned plans for big skyscraper, tall, you know, 12, 15 story buildings. They're going to have a more modest sized, you know, I think 5 or 6 stories. The athletic center, they were going to think about, you know, a 50,000 person stadium, that's going to be considerably smaller. So they are, you know, revising things down a little bit, but they're not bailing out, right? I mean, they are still committed, Melody, to the Port Covington site for moving their offices, right?
That's right. They say they're committed to that and committed to that ideal. In fact, they also say the one building they own at Tide Point is going to be going on the market.
Ethan McLeod's an associate. Yeah, good for them. Ethan McLeod is an associate editor at the Baltimore Business Journal, and Melody Simmons is a reporter. She covers real estate and economic development for the BBJ. Thanks to you both. Appreciate it. We'll check in again soon.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Coming up, Leatrice Gant of Baltimore Ceasefire 365 joins me to talk about this weekend's ceasefire events. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.